Hi everybody, my name is Sean from Follow the Camino, and on this episode of Camino Talks, I'm talking with Tom Friesen from the Canadian Company of Pilgrims, which is a non-denominational volunteer-run association that supports Canadians interested in the pilgrimage of Santiago de Compostela. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Sean.
So first of all, I'd just like to kind of start with kind of the basic questions, like who is Tom Friesen and what is your role within the Canadian Company of Pilgrims?
I finished my working life as a teacher of the deaf. I worked at a school for the deaf for over 30 years, had a great time doing that. And then when that ended, looked for a new phase of my life, the Camino was there for me. I joined a hiking group and found out about the Camino, and there's a local support group here in London, Ontario, Canada. We have local chapters across the country, and each group sort of operates on its own, in its own way. It's coordinated naturally, but very loosely. We're more enabled than actually controlled at all. And I'm a local chapter coordinator, and have been for a number of years, because I love this kind of conversation and this kind of community. And I worked as an hospitalero in Spain in 2006, following my first Camino in 2005. Following that, I worked a couple of postings, and then the people who trained us in Toronto, Ontario, had done at a joint meeting of the American Pilgrims on the Camino and the Canadian Company of Pilgrims. And together we had this training with about 35 people with trainers from Spain. And the people from Spain were telling us that they were not sure if it was going to continue because they weren't seeing enough people coming over to respond to the training to justify sending people over from Europe as they had done for a couple of years ahead. So that training is that they offered had ended in North America, and I actually attended a training that they were having down in Williamsburg, Virginia in 2007. And I approached Mary Virtue, who was a friend I'd met in 2005 and had gone off to serve that year as a hospitalera. She and I decided that we would run our own trainings here in Canada, and we asked for permission from the Spanish Federation to do that. So we've been offering trainings to people over the last probably 13 years. Okay. And probably had about 30 trainings here in Canada.
Great. Thank you. So the topic of this conversation is around hospitaleros, but maybe for people that haven't been on the Camino, what is a hospitalero? What is an albergue? Why is it important? What can they expect if they have not heard of this?
Fair question. I think, to me, the marvelous hospitality of Spain makes the Camino possible as a route that's accessible to everyone. Most of the albergues or pilgrim shelters, they also call them refugios. In France, they call them gîtes. Most of them are private enterprise operations. Somebody has basically opened their part of their home or a building specifically in order to give people hospitality and to earn a living. And I worked at a private albergue, and that was an interesting experience. The other option, though, are donativos, and those are less frequent, but they are either a parochial space, part of a church, or possibly in the manse of a church, the priest's home from a church, or it could be a municipal, so it could be a part of the city property or a city building that's been turned over to make space for pilgrims. Or the other one could be association of pilgrims who want to open up something and support. And there certainly are international associations that have their albergues in Spain and other countries as well. The donativos do not charge a set fee. We ask people for a donation to keep the albergue open, but we do not base their entrance on what they give us or the way they're treated on that basis either. So it's something that we do to hopefully convey the hospitality and the spirituality of the community.
Okay, so in essence, the albergues are kind of places where pilgrims can stay at no or little cost. And it's all about kind of the community involvement, and hospitaleros are people that volunteer for a period of weeks to help out and operate these kind of accommodations.
Yes, in many of the albergues, the hospitaleros are actually the owners or their family, and they're collecting money for that. And often the charge might be around 10 euros for a night's stay in Spain. Some are more expensive in France. about the same in Portugal, more expensive in Italy as well. The group I work with does have volunteers. With the donativos, we on average take in less money that way because people will come and decide that donativo means free. We try to convince them it doesn't, but having volunteers is the only way to keep that kind of system open and available.
So it kind of sounds to me a little bit like when I was a lot younger and I was traveling around Asia and Australia, and you had all these youth hostels, and people would actually stay for a week or two, and they would kind of, I suppose, wash up and make meals for accommodation. So it sounds something like that, but there's probably something more, like, because I understand a lot of the hospitaleros go back again and again to do the same thing.
Exactly right. The albergue you describe, it basically has a welcome reception area. Often there's a kitchen and dining room. Sometimes the hospitalero, especially in parochials, will organize a meal, often with the help of the pilgrims. The pilgrims are also welcome to go out and eat in the community. And by having the albergue there, the community often has a basis of a financial support to keep going. And I, as a member of the community for the half month that I volunteer to work, you're quite popular because they recognize that you're enabling sustenance for the community and hospitality. The one difference, perhaps, though, from what you're describing is that you're expected to stay for only one night and then to move on unless you're sick or injured. And it depends on the time of the year as well, how flexible the hospital will be about that. I've worked in several seasons of the year. Typically right now I'm mostly working in November, so I've got a sort of a routine that works for me on a yearly basis. It's a quieter time of the year, so I'm somewhat more flexible about people's stay. But normally the expectation is you stay for one night.
So it's all part of the I suppose the onward movement of the pilgrimage. It's a place to kind of stay, rest for one night, and then move on to the next part of your pilgrimage.
I should also say that to stay at the albergue, you need a credencial or a credential, and that's like your pilgrim passport, and that is stamped nightly at the passport and dated at the albergue as part of the check-in, and it's actually a requirement when you get to Santiago as a pilgrim. If you want to get a Compostela, they require actually 2 stamps per day for the last 100 kilometers, and they're actually only looking at the last 100 kilometers for walking pilgrims, and the last 200 kilometers for bicyclists or people who are on horseback.
Okay, so what makes somebody want to do this on the Camino? Why not experience the same kind of life on a trail in Canada or the United States? I'm sure there are kind of hostels, accommodations that you could do something similar. Sure. What is special about the Camino?
I think there's a number of things that make the Camino quite unique, although I recognize that there are other pilgrim routes in the world. We have some in Canada, and certainly other countries have their share of them. I think, for me, the tremendous sense of hospitality that the Spanish have, and the fact that if you talk to them, they will often say, someday I would like to do the Camino. And so there's a sense of you're welcome, you're honored, you're doing something that they feel has true value. I think the other elements of that are you have left your own place, and I kind of describe a pilgrim as a person who leaves home to find themselves. I think when you step away from your job, from your role in your family, from your role in your community, you are free of some expectations that other people place on you or they put on for yourself, and you give yourself a sort of a gift of time to explore what is really important in your life, what is really valuable to you. And walking for several hours often brings out the endorphins in people. So there's a natural communal high that builds out of the physical. And we often joke that people look like pilgrims after a couple of weeks because their clothes are a little bit more loose fitting. They're not quite there. And they're usually if they're walking the Camino Frances from the Pyrenees to Santiago in the west of Spain, they've got a sunburn on the left side of their face, and that they also kind of often have a limp or a gait because they've either picked up a blister or some other physical pain. And I will joke with people when they come in, oh, andas como peregrino, you're walking like a pilgrim. But I think beyond that, there's this sense of community, that you're walking with people from all over the world, And it doesn't matter what their racial background, their faith background, their culture, their language is, you can connect. And we often see what we call either teams or communal family, or one of my friends called communal pods, of people traveling across, taking on roles where they actually work and support and help each other. One person's the medic, one person's the guide, someone's the translator, someone's the cook, someone's the social director, someone's the intervener, peacemaker. They may be the same person taking some of several of these roles, but people do work together, and you find that you're walking with people that you care deeply about, it. And people often form friendships that last well beyond the Camino.
Yes, indeed. So I did the part of the Camino last October with several friends from Logroño to Burgos, and I came across quite a number of Canadians, actually. In fairness, mostly women in their kind of late 50s into 60s. Yeah. And it was amazing, both those ladies and other people that we met, the amount of people walking to kind of look for a change in their life. So it seems that a lot of people do the Camino either because something has happened dramatically in their life and they're trying to kind of process it or recover, or they're looking for something and they think by going on a pilgrimage on the Camino, they'll get the headspace to actually kind of work out what is next or what they should do. Is that your experience?
For sure. I walked at a time when I was just in the first year of my retirement. And with that, I was looking for new activities and new opportunities, ways to learn new things, keep my mind and my body active. I sent you that thing of the story about the fellow in the one albergue. And in the very, very first chapter, just let me read what I see as some of the motives that people take the Camino. Penance. Gratitude, searching for a new direction, grief for a loss, retirement changes, those could also be marriage changes, renewal of body and spirit, tourism, cultural, and language expansion. Those all serve, I think, as motives that people use for walking the Camino. And it's very interesting to talk to people about that, because very quickly, people will ask that question, why are you walking the Camino? And they will open up to each other in ways that they may never open up to family and friends back home.
And do people always find the answer?
No, I think, you know, well, I think sometimes, you know, I know that the Camino has made marriages and it's also broken them. I think often people feel that the solution is more Camino. I'm often interested in people who do the Camino and find it a gratifying experience and then go on to something else and don't. I think because I'm a person who likes to go back and redo experiences I've enjoyed and just widen and deepen them. It's hard to speak for everybody what they're looking for. I think if you go with fewer expectations, you probably come back with more satisfaction.
Okay, thank you. One of the things that I'm interested in kind of getting your view on is kind of the Holy Year and the purpose behind the Holy Year and the Camino, and 2021 is the next Holy Year. So maybe if you could explain what is the Holy Year, why it's important, and why it's important on the Camino.
On a year when St. James Day, which is July 25th, you're probably aware that most Catholic saints have a specific day attached to their celebrating their life and what they achieve. So July 25th is the holy day for St. James. And many people have a St. James activity that they will do. But when that holy day or that date falls on a Sunday, then it becomes an Año Jacobeo or a holy year, which has special meaning in Santiago. They have a door at the back of the cathedral that they open, which is called the La Puerta de Perdón, the door of pardon. And that door is only open during holy years. And your Compostela has extra meaning for arriving there. I think you may get more time shaved off your time in purgatory than in a normal year. It certainly creates a bulge of people coming into Santiago. In normal years, about half the people who arrive in Santiago are Spanish. And the other half come from hundreds of countries around the world, literally. May have less religious intent. I certainly feel that there's a lot of people on the Camino, probably a third in my estimation, who are walking with some certainly religious, and maybe widen that to spiritual reason for doing it. But the annus Iacobaeus are special. They happen every 5, 6, or 11 years, depending on when the leap year falls. We leapt over the last Sunday when it would have been July 25th in the last leap year. So therefore, it's been 11 years since the last holy year. It's always a bulge on the Camino to see how many pilgrims are there. Next year, it's going to be interesting because I don't know that the Camino will be fully back in operation even by then. Certainly, probably the numbers will be somewhat muted by the current crisis we're having.
Indeed. And so with the extra kind of population of pilgrims on the Camino next year, is there going to be a kind of a rush or challenge for beds? Because I know I've seen pilgrims, they actually rush ahead to try to get a bed in the next town.
Yep. Certainly in the busy times of year, there is a preoccupation with getting beds. Now, I can only tell you what the experience was in the last holy year, which was 2010. From Canada that year, we spent 35 hospitaleros or more to Spain. And I think people said, oh, I'm going to be tough to walk there. I think I'll go and serve instead. So we actually, that was our highest year for sending Canadian hospitaleros to help in Spain. We usually send somewhere between 20 and 30, but that 2010, we had not only been training people for a couple of years, and many people went to work. However, they really tried to bump up the infrastructure for the Camino in 2010. And the word I heard by the by was that they were actually surprised that on the Camino Frances, there wasn't as much stress and strain as they thought there was going to be for people finding beds. That the other routes, the Camino is not actually accurate. You should say the Caminos because there are several different ways to get to Santiago. I often think of a scallop shell with its radiating fan of spines as the idea of all the routes arriving at the center in Santiago. And so there's all these different routes to get there. The other routes took the pressure. The people were heading to those ones thinking that they would be quieter, and everybody had the same thought. So the people in the Frances who had bumped up their services to try and take this load were a little bit surprised that they weren't more stressed than they were.
Okay, very good. But regardless of the amount of people on Camino, everyone will have a good time, I think, and it will be extra special if we get through this current situation with the coronavirus, COVID-19. I think there's going to be pent-up demand, and people more than ever will be looking for some kind of back to nature, away from the crowds, something a bit more than just the normal, going to work and going home.
One of my current interests, actually, is how to try and keep the Camino alive and available for people when we can't actually physically go on the Camino. When I just recently came back from a gathering with the American Pilgrims in their annual gathering in Lake Tahoe, and I had to come back and cancel our spring meeting for our local chapter and two hospitalero trainings, one here locally and one 3,000 kilometers west of here. And that was just for safety and for to meet the rules that they're now demanding in terms of limited meeting spaces. But I'm trying to keep contact using Zoom as a major way to chat with people, to extend information, to provide resources. And there are lots of podcasts and blogs and books. And I also went on Amazon very quickly and ordered several books to read to hold me over while I was locked in place.
Yes. Yeah. So just on the topic of books, there are lots of books from people who have walked the Camino. And mm-hmm. I suppose from North America, we've noticed that, and I'm going back now 10 years, so this is the 10th anniversary of the release of the film The Way with Martin Sheen. Yep. Yes. And that is the number one source of people's knowledge of the Camino, and people still say, oh, I watched the movie and I want to do the Camino. In terms of books and Canadian kind of celebrities, are there any standout kind of Canadian authors or standout Canadian celebrities that have introduced the Camino to more people?
Well, the Canadian Company of Pilgrims celebrated their 25th anniversary last year as an organization. They started actually as a little company of pilgrims, and they were in the Toronto area. And then as other people saw what they were doing and they wanted to join on, it became a national organization through the internet and through the webpage. In 2008, I approached an official from Galicia about holding an art show here in Canada. And he got very excited because he says, our statistics in 2000, and this was the year before The Way, I think, are that 6% of the pilgrims arriving in Santiago are Canadian, but only 4% are American. And when you think that the Americans basically outnumber us by a factor of 9 times, that was out of kilter with the demographics of who should have been available. The way changed that dramatically. You meet a lot more Americans now than you do Canadians. Canadians, I don't think the numbers have gone down, but the American numbers and the Anglo numbers have gone back up again. It was inspirational for people to see that movie. And there's a number of things about that movie that I thought had real tremendous value. There were a few areas where they Hollywoodized it. And I've got some friends in Spain who weren't too fond of the portrayal as they actually gave Spanish people.
Yeah. Oh, very good. So one of the things, or one of the topics that you mentioned you'd like to talk about when we exchanged the emails was around unpacking Caminos, the return home. Yeah. Maybe explain what that is and why it's of interest.
Well, I think people go to the Camino and they find it to be this amazing experience. And they come home and they try to talk to their friends about it, who haven't done it and maybe not too interested in doing it. And their friends ask a couple of questions like, so you slept in a dorm with a bunch of people in bunk beds and there was 24 of you in the same room and people were snoring and making other noises and you walked 25 kilometers a day and everything was in your pack. And then the conversation quickly turns to, you think this particular team will win the championship this year? Because people have no reference for it. And here somebody has come back with a burning desire to talk about something that's been central and critical in their life, and they don't have a community or a connection for that. So when we have meetings, we're having a virtual meeting tomorrow, and because of the electronic, I won't be able to separate two groups. We always separate two groups after coffee. Coffee in the middle, we use as an opportunity to let people see who's walked which routes and when, so that people can buttonhole each other at coffee and exchange phone numbers or email addresses and get together and have a conversation afterwards. But in the second half, we have a program for new people heading out. So what you put in your pack and how you walk without getting blisters and what kind of food is available, the kind of language you should learn. And then we do a second session for people who've been experienced on the Camino. And very, very often we have what we call unpacking your Camino. And the format's quite simple. I vary it because often it's the same people there. But in general, we ask people something like, what were your expectations ahead of going? What were the surprises you had? What were the challenges you had? What are you thinking about remembering most? And then how are you keeping your Camino alive in your life when you can't be on the Camino? And we share those, and I think people find a community group that has similar feelings. And often we get a book or a reference or something that is of some value. And so that is an opportunity to unpack their Camino a bit, as you will. I often refer to, we mentioned books, and there's a couple of books I like for people starting out. Robert Ward, and let me make sure I get the title right. All the Good Pilgrims.
Okay.
Mary Wallace from Calgary. Hers is Among the Pilgrims. She's a classic scholar, so she gives you a lot of great background in terms of what the background behind what you're seeing. But the book that I always recommend for people who have come back from the Camino and want to sort of make sense of it is this book by Arthur Boers. And it's called The Ways Made by Walking, from the Antonio Machado poem. And in chapter 10 there, he talks about focal living experience. And he recognizes that's not his term, but that is an awareness or a recognition that when you're doing something that is totally integrated with your personality and your skills and your values, and you feel this is just something you were meant to be doing, then you're in a focal living experience. And he talks in another book, Living into Focus, the idea that in our commercialized, competitive advertising world, we lose sight of what we really want to do, where we plan to go in life. And that when we get to the Camino, we suddenly find that we're doing something that just seems totally integrated with our personality, with our goals, with the people we want to be. And he talks about four attestations about that you can answer yes to each of the points that are said. There's no place I would rather be. There's nothing I'd rather be doing. There's no one I would rather be with. This I will remember well. And I think the Camino has that effect on people, and they go, yeah, that's exactly what I was supposed to be doing right there. And often people consider the Camino a watershed moment in their life, that before the Camino, they were this job or this role in the family or this type of person in the community. After the Camino, they're quite comfortable calling themselves a pilgrim and saying, I'm a pilgrim, and I'm happy to connect with other pilgrims.
One of the things I enjoyed doing the Camino was, and I find, I suppose before I went, I'd never really done a kind of walking holiday tour or whatever. I'd been walking, I'd been hiking, but never for a week or more. Great. And I found that the fact that there was no deadlines, there was no, you didn't have to be somewhere at a certain time, you didn't have to pick up the kids, you didn't have to spend 3 hours and then leave. You just kind of, you walk and then you stop when you get there, and then you walk again and you stop when you get there the next day. I thought that was really special and kind of unique in this modern life.
Each day opens new and with a familiar rhythm, but with its own surprises and joys.
Indeed. Have you seen a difference in the type of people that do the Caminos? What we see, I suppose, in our company, we're seeing more and more families looking to do it, or intergenerational, so mothers and daughters, or kind of even grandparents and teenage kids. There seems to be a different profile now, or it's becoming more mainstream.
Well, I first watched in 2005, so I've got a 15-year perspective. I don't have a 1,000-year-old perspective. It's interesting to look at the footprint of the towns and see how the towns were all stretched out along the Camino, and that they're starting, some of them, in some cases, they're starting to re-energize. One of my very first postings as an hospitalero was in Fontabedon, and Fontabedon at the time only had one woman living there full time. And that's somewhat changed. Now there's more albergues open and more businesses open, and the Camino has re-energized that, because the numbers have consistently built since 2000. There's been a steep uptick in the number of people going. So in the early days, of course, people weren't using cell phones. Now it's very common to see people walking along, talking on their cell phone. I kind of miss the early days when it was a bit more quiet experience. You could hear the cuckoos and the church bells and not the ringing of mobile phones. But I think also there's also been some commercialism to the Camino. Now, if we go back 500 years, that it would have been like that too, because they were to have half a million people walking to Santiago and half a million people walking back home. These people obviously required services that those communities were happy to provide for them. And I've talked to Spanish people, and they say, I'm doing this job because this gives my family some employment. And one of my good friends in Spain, who I met on the Camino walking the first year I walked, he has a business for his children, and they provide a guide for people to, and they'll book places for people to stay. So some number of people will book their Camino from hostel to hostel because they don't want to be in the crowds of people sleeping at night, or they fear bed bugs, which doesn't mean they're not necessarily going to get them in the hotels. But anyway, so there is more commercial aspects, and that gives people more options. Sometimes people would get dropped off at the beginning of town by a van, and they would walk through this historic town and stop and get their pilgrim passports, and they knock on the door, or I have a passport sitting at the door, and then they come in for the sale, or a stamp that goes on the credential. And then they would go out of town, and they would get back on the bus, and they would drive the boring miles between special places. And that's their Camino. I don't put any judgment on how a person does the Camino. I think the Camino hopefully makes you less judgmental. You don't know what people are carrying in their backpacks or what their body is going through. So it's not for us to judge. It's just for us to be open to welcoming people and giving them the smile of hospitality when they arrive.
Yeah, indeed. Changing topics slightly, what is your view on, I suppose, other regions, other countries looking to establish their own type of Camino? I know here in Ireland there are a number of kind of pilgrim routes that actually make up part of the distance that you require for your credential. I know in the UK, even in Canada, I read about so a Camino on Prince Edward Island. So
yes,
what is the your position on the non-traditional Caminos?
I think, well, I'm one of the other hats that I wear as a volunteer is with Hiking Trails, and I was a president of Hike Ontario, which is an over umbrella group that helped to facilitate and organize hiking trails across our province. And the fact that people can step on a volunteer managed trail at one of our lakes and walk 600 or 800 kilometers and find themselves in another part of the province, all on volunteer trails, to me is a tremendous source of pride. So I'm glad to see this opening up. I don't know that we're get the same kind of open hospitality where Spanish, what they charge for staying in an albergue is probably half of what the French charge. And but maybe from my experience, maybe a third of what the Italians charge. So, you know, and the Portuguese are fairly inexpensive as well. That sense of hospitality, I think, goes back. I mean, they can make a good living doing that, but they're not gouging. They're trying to enable. Yes. And I think if we do that, if we enable, and you know, there are real authentic pilgrimages in other places and with other religions, and I see that as very healthy. Times when I've been thrilled on the Camino is when, for example, I've seen a Korean fellow walking with a Japanese friend, and for them to be friends, if you know the history, the tortured history of those countries. That's a wonderful thing. And I've seen other friendships that cross over what would have been old foes. And now are people who, you know, you'll often hear people saying, if only we get the world leaders of the world to walk on the Camino, we'd have world peace. And I think if we extend the Camino to other places, that can only be a good thing.
Yes, indeed. You also said you'd like to touch upon, I suppose, the understanding of the culture and customs of Spain. And I know from personal experience and working in our own company, people's expectations of a 2-star or 1-star or what they will get is probably wildly different from what they actually do get, which it causes challenges. So what do you have to say about that?
Well, I love the Camino and I think it's a spectacular experience, but I don't think it does a very good job of actually orienting people to what's actually going on in Spain. One of the advantages of being a hospitalero is if you're staying in one place as a ciudadano, as a citizen of the town or the city for an extended period of time. And the second time you go into a place as a customer to order coffee or a meal is when the Spanish kind of open up their hearts to you and start to recognize you as somebody who has worth to talk to, etc. So being able to, and that's one of the advantages of being a hospitalero is to get to know a place and get to know Spanish people and their rhythm. If you think about the pilgrims, they get up early in the morning and try and get out of town before it gets too warm. So they've left the town before the shutters have come up in the stores and people are out in the street. Spanish people in the morning are greeting each other and having coffee and having a gay old time and not in any hurry at all to transact their business. The social connectedness is much more important. I love that lesson for us. Their markets are open. Their markets typically are open until like 1 o'clock in the afternoon and the stores start to shutter down for the siesta hour. And the pilgrims arrive in town. And I can remember my first Camino walking into town and going, nobody lives here. Where is everybody? And you don't get a sense of what's actually going on. Behind the walls, in their gardens, in their homes, in the restaurants and bars, they're having a very good time having an extended meal and really wishing each other buen provecho, but enjoy your meal. I don't know if the Irish have an expression like that, but I always joke that the English translation of that is bon appétit.
Yes.
Anyway, the pilgrims also head to bed early and therefore that they miss the time when the Spanish are out in the streets. Spanish people will drive to their downtown parking lots, take out their carriages and their stuff, walk around till all hours with their kids dressed in their finery and meeting and greeting each other and admiring the children and having a wonderful time socially. And then they go for dinner and they don't go to dinner till 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And they have amazing stamina. They can go late into the night and get up the next day for work. I don't know how they do it, to be honest with you, but the pilgrims miss that. And Spain has a very interesting set of cultural expectations and differences that are significant and that have been in some cases tragic for them and tragic for other countries, but are tremendously interesting and worth understanding. And the pilgrims in their preoccupation with the pack and their feet don't kind of see as widely as I'd like them to.
Yes, indeed. And there are, I guess, certain times of the year where it's actually more interesting to go to Spain on the Camino around kind of harvest time, when all the little towns, villages have their harvest festivals and the communities come out for communal meals and kind of almost parties in the evening time. And I think they are special.
Yeah, if you're a pilgrim and you found out that there was a festival in the village that night or that the next day, it'd be worthwhile staying over to see that, just to get an appreciation, understanding of it. One thing I'd like to say is that when you walk as your travel option, you're able to walk and encounter the local people who live there. And as opposed to a bus or a train or a plane, you're going by at such a speed that there's no opportunity for engagement, no opportunity for finding out from the people there what their customs, what their values are, what they find sacred about a place. And I think when you are able to engage local people and really enter into a mini relationship, then you become a traveler. And I always want to be a traveler over being a tourist. Although I'll freely admit that my first trip to Spain, I was thinking of it as a tourist exercise. But when I met people that I care about deeply now and saw places that I thought had true value and wonderful ways of operating and great hospitality, the historic sites, the monuments of the churches and the shrines, the chapels, the music, that all was so engaging that I think I got transformed into a pilgrim and a traveler.
Yes. So what would be your your favorite memory or favorite place on the Camino?
When people say, what's your favorite Camino? I always say, what's the Camino I'm on right now? And I've been very lucky to walk a number of the routes. I walked across the whole country from Roncesvalles to Santiago and on to Finisterre the first year in 2005. The next year, I only walked a part of it to walk to 2 weeks with my Mallorcan friends so that we could finish up the Camino together that they had to abandon when their holidays were over at Ponferrada. I love that walk over past the Cross of Iron, walking into the Bierzo Valley. As you see the towns, El Acebo, Molina Seca, Ponferrada, laid out below you, it's quite spectacular. You're also walking downhill, which is a little easier, harder on your body, but easier on you physically. I can think of things for each of the Caminos that I value and loved about them and would go back for. The woman I walk with is one of my friends from 2005, and she gets laid off from her job at the airport in Mallorca every November, which is why I go back in November. We walk for about a week together, and she always wants to walk a different route, which I think is a hoot, because when I say, Rosa, remember when we did this? No, I don't remember that.
Yes. So maybe on a more serious note in the current climate, do you kind of worry for, I suppose, the future of the Camino and the future of the albergues and the dormitories with, I suppose, social distancing and maybe what's going to happen in the future with people being more conscious about large groups or...
I do in the short term, Sean. Certainly, I think it's going to take us probably until there's a vaccine available against the coronavirus to be secure that it's not going to come back and flare up again. A number of friends were either on the point of leaving for the Camino or had to get themselves back from the Camino. And you'll talk to Leah Pennick, and she had a bit of a journey to get back to get off the Camino and get back when the coronavirus interrupted her Camino. And I heard that story from a few people. I'm not sure that the Camino will be backed up to full speed even next year, depending on vaccines. I don't know. My normal when I open up a yearly calendar is to go to November and pencil in my dates to go to Spain. We'll have to see whether that's going to be available. I'm not totally terribly optimistic that it's totally going to be available. It would be a great opportunity right now to go across the entire Camino and fumigate every single albergue that's there and try and knock the bedbug population down quite a bit. well, no pilgrims are there to be harmed in the doing of it. But I don't know if anybody's coordinating that effort. I may suggest it to the American Pilgrims because they have grant money that they generously dole out to worthy groups.
Yeah. But I, maybe on a positive note, I think as the kind of the various regions come back, I think the openness and the kind of, I suppose, the less crowded parts of the world are going to be more attractive to people. I think the Camino is one of those where it's away from the crowds, it's fresh air. I think that will have significant benefit.
I think it's valuable in any shape. Honestly, I think there's real value. I walked the Camino in very quiet times, and February, March, November, December, and enjoyed it tremendously. But I've also walked in busier times in April, May. It gets busy sort of Holy Week on through the middle of October. And I found value in both experiences for sure. And it'll always be there for sure. It's not gonna go away. I don't know if you know the story of Elias Velinha, San Pedro.
I don't.
He was the priest who was at El Sobrero. And El Sobrero is a lovely mountaintop village that is the first village you enter when you're entering Galicia, the last province of Spain, where Santiago is. He was a historian, and he was there in the 80s when there was only dozens of pilgrims arriving in Santiago, not hundreds of thousands. And he wanted to reanimate the Camino. So he did some historical research on where it went. And then he caged some yellow paint from the Department of Highways, the paint that they would use to paint the yellow lines down the road. And he started swapping these yellow arrows all across Spain. And it was his idea that we just put an arrow down on a route that points towards Santiago. And he was doing this gaily for a few years. And at one point, apparently, the Guardia Civil saw him on by side of the road, and you know, he put the paint on trees and fences and rocks and houses and churches and city hall. It didn't matter to him. He just slapped his paint down. And they said to him, "Elias, what are you doing with these yellow arrows?" And he said, "I am preparing for a great invasion." So he was also a prophet as well as a priest. Because yeah, that's what we have right now.
Yeah, I know. And maybe one or two last questions for you now. We've spoken about your favorite Caminos or locations, and there are so many. What is the most interesting person you've met?
There's been a number of them. One of the very first ones I met when we were walking our very first Camino, the woman I walked with did not like to go off the route too much. But one day we veered a little bit off the Camino Frances, and we went over to a place called Eyunate, which is just before Puente de la Reina. It's on the Camino Aragonés, where the Aragonés comes in and joins the Frances at Olvanos. But it's basically an eight-sided church that's by itself out in the country. There's a kind of a half colonnade there with it. People think because of the eight sides, it may have been a Templar church, but it doesn't have anything in that area apart fields and one outbuilding, which probably was the stables at one point in time. And the stables have been reworked into an albergue. And we went into the church, and they were playing Gregorian chants and speakers over the church. So we actually lingered there for quite a while. And then my friends, the Mallorquinas, the women from Mallorca, and they like to get stamps at universities and museums and other albergues. Never bars, because that was turístico. Wouldn't do that, but other places. So they went to the door and they knocked on the door to get a sale for the passports that they were carrying, the credentials. And this little woman answered the door, and she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to put the sale out. Why don't you come in and have some tea with me?" And later on, her husband said, "Oh, she gave you her chai tea. She doesn't give that to everybody. She must have liked you at first sight." But as we walked in the door, there was a poster on the wall, and it said, "A Gathering of Pilgrims, Toronto, Ontario, May 2005. And I pointed to it, and I said, "I'm going to that." And she said, "I'm going to that too." And because she was a hospitalera, I said, "I'm going to take the hospitalero training there." I'd already signed up for that. And she said, "Good, I will be your teacher."
That's excellent.
And so, her albergue was like seven mats on the floor. That was all that was there. But she was the teacher for this course. She came and gave us an amazing course. She sang like an angel. She played the guitar. I love singing. And she really caught me there. And she gave us a great course. And then because there was a day between that course and the American Pilgrim Gathering and the Canadian Company Pilgrim Gathering, joint gathering, I offered to drive them down to Niagara Falls. So I rented a car. As we got in the car, she confided to me. She said, "Actually, in Spain, when they found that I got an intrauterine tumor, and they told me I should stay and get that operated and not be coming here." but I felt this was important and I committed to come. So here I am. And she lay in the car, not very, without much motion. We got to Niagara Falls and she was out in the deck of the, outside the Horseshoe Falls for about half an hour. And that was enough for that. And then we went to the Butterfly Museum and that engaged her for me 45 minutes. And then we got back in the car and she kind of lay as one who was passed out for the rest of the journey. I didn't see her for the rest of the conference. She went back to Spain, got operated on. Unfortunately, the tumors were benign. And she's now a grandmother in Amsterdam. Because of her daughters having grandchildren, she's an abuela in Amsterdam. But she was inspirational to me as a kind of person who opens the door, smiles, and lets you come in. And so as a model for me, that's a strong identity I have. I carry the muñequito. This is the emblem of the Hospitalero Voluntario, and it's basically a person with their arms outstretched in welcome. And the idea is we extend hospitality to all. And inside the emblem are a bunch of other people with their arms similarly outstretched. And that hospitality ethic is a very strong feature of my life with my family and with my friends and with the community.
Okay, that's a very inspiring story, Tom. So Tom, I'm going to leave it there. I really appreciate you taking this time to kind of, I suppose, give your view on the life of a hospitalero, what people can expect on the Camino. And I really hope you're back walking on the Camino in the not too distant future.
Yeah, I hope you all are. It is possible to do the Camino wherever you are, you know, just as a perspective. I'm happy to talk about it. I always joke that if you're a new pilgrim, for goodness sake, speak to an experienced pilgrim. We'll probably give you no new information at all, but you're giving us free therapy. So thank you for the free therapy today.
Very good. Well, thank you. And I hope to talk to you soon in the future.
I would welcome that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom.
Have a good day.
And you. Bye-bye.